This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The first case of the Omicron variant in the United States was reported early last week in California. Since that report, the federal government has announced its plans to address the winter surge, variants, and vaccination needs. To learn more about the Omicron variant, we're joined now by Shandy Dirth, Director for the Center of Public Health Practice at IUPUI School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. And just a reminder, if you're listening to this live right now and you have a pressing question or a comment or any of that stuff, make sure to give us a call at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881, or you can message us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. Shandy, welcome to the program. Graham, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, although I would be happy to talk about something other than COVID at some point.
Yes. Well, let's start with the Omicron variant. Shandy, how was this found? For those who may not have been following all of the headlines that have been inundating our feeds.
So basically, really strong surveillance systems have been set up around the world to look for variants, because we know we still have a lot of transmission going on out there with COVID. And so scientists are constantly looking for mutations, for changes, for new variants. And this was found in South Africa first. And I just have to give kudos to South Africa, because they've been very transparent. They were out in the public right away. They went to WHO, World Health Organization, to do the report. And they've been very forthcoming and sharing information with the world so that we can all get on the same page at the same time and figure out what's going on with the new variant.
I think initially folks were saying that South Africa was being punished for being so transparent, because it's like almost immediately plans were put in place. Maybe some travel restrictions going to go into effect. Was this a good response, Shandy?
So I can see the response needed to cut down the transmission as soon as possible. But, you know, it could be a situation where the cat might already be out of the bag. And I can say I can see the reason why some people think the reaction was that way, because it was South Africa. Would this have happened in London? You know, are we really being equitable when we do some of these shutdowns in transportation? So I think we need to look at that across the board. I don't have a yes or no on that one, but I can definitely see the outcry and why that was there, about why everyone was so quick to shut down travel. And honestly, what we've seen now is that variant had been around for a few days, obviously, before it was reported, and we've seen how quickly it spread. And so that may have been, honestly, too little too late.
Right. And as more cases are being discovered, it makes me wonder if it's been around for a while, and maybe only South Africa was transparent enough to report it.
That's true. You know, this could have potentially started somewhere else, and they were the first ones to find it. Right now, we're just seeing so much of it there. There's a good chance that it could have started there. Again, it's just not definitive. Same thing, where we don't have definitive answers on exactly where COVID started the very first time.
Right. Well, Graham, how are variants formed?
Well, you know, viruses mutate all the time, and some of the mutations aren't beneficial to the virus, but sometimes they are. And that's exactly what viruses want to do. They want to survive and replicate. And so they pick those up over time. And we think, you know, in a couple cases of these more better known variants, one, I think we're realizing that coronaviruses probably mutate a little bit more frequently than we thought they were, or at least they do when we have a global pandemic and this much spread occurring. Excuse me. But with some of these particular variants, it's very likely that they actually manifested in just a single immunocompromised individual that couldn't kick that infection and had a persistent infection over time. And so, you know, with Delta, which is highly contagious and still raging here in the U.S. and Indiana, that particular variant has 9 mutations on the spike protein. Of course, the spike protein is what can identify and latch on and enter our human cells. And so that one's very important. And with Omicron, it has 32 mutations just on that spike protein alone. And so some of those are more concerning based on what we already know. A lot of them we don't know much about. It even shares some genetic code with some of the common cold coronaviruses as well. And then maybe that makes it really adapt to human hosts, and potentially why it's more maybe going to be more transmissible on Delta. It certainly appears that way based on the surface of the information we have so far. But I think it also goes to show, really, with this push that we need for global health equity, for vaccine equity, because, you know, if there are pockets of the world that are going to remain unvaccinated for some amount of time, that puts everybody else at risk. And, you know, it's retrospect, of course, but, you know, we could have really spent the last year pushing out more vaccines globally to reduce the chance of these type of things occurring.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the cold virus, and I was just thinking about, since it's a version, it's a coronavirus, correct? It's one of the many forms of it.
It's a lot of different viruses, yes, but there are several human coronaviruses that can cause illness in humans, and a couple of those are basically your common cold.
Mm-hmm. Do you think folks or scientists are able to find things for the common cold with the research that they're doing for COVID?
I would think so. I would hope so. But, you know, it also mutates rather frequently. And then we don't tend to have a lot of long-term immunity with a lot of the common cold viruses. And I think, you know, I think we knew that generally with coronaviruses before the pandemic. And I think that's why we're seeing that kind of marked waning immunity, either after natural infection or vaccine-induced immunity.
Shandy, what do we know about the cases of Omicron right now in the U.S.?
So at this point, we're up to 17 states reporting cases around the U.S. Many of those cases still have some sort of connection to travel to South Africa. So we don't see widespread transmission yet here in the U.S., but within another week or two, that could be a very different situation. As Graham said, right now, this is looking possibly even more infectious, more transmissible than Delta, which we know has already hit us really hard. And so we're really expecting to see more and more cases reported here in the U.S. that don't have any travel history in the coming days.
Well, Graham, how is the process or what is the process of finding variants? I'm just imagining if folks aren't getting tested, how would we know if it's out there?
That's a great point. And, you know, a year ago, we were not doing really much surveillance at all or enough to be proactive or preventative, I would say. And I think in the last year, we've gotten better. It's probably four or five times as many as we were sequencing last year, but it's still pretty low. Now, the way that we have the surveillance set up nationally, it should pick up things pretty quickly. It's just kind of sporadic in different areas of the country. But other countries like South Africa, as we've seen, have much more robust surveillance systems in place. The UK does a lot more sequencing than we do, for example, as well. But I think if there's one little blessing, at least with this variant that we know already, is a lot of or these viruses have specific gene markers. And if we remember back to the spring, we had Alpha here, the UK variant, B117. And that specific variant, you could actually detect through a general PCR test. It has a certain S gene, a spike protein dropout that the PCR tests look for. They look for a few different gene markers. And so if that one dropped out, but you still had the others there, that would still be a positive result. But that would tell us, essentially at that time, that that was Alpha. Well, Delta does not have that dropout, but Omicron does. So we can actually detect this in PCR testing if you're using the certain test kits without sequencing. And so that we've kind of already informed our labs at the university to look out for that as a potential early indicator. And then if we do see that, we can send it along for further sequencing.
That's interesting. Chandy, what do we know about Omicron so far? I know it's probably still too early to get much information, but when it compares to Delta, you know, there's just so much information out there that seems to contradict each other. What is something that maybe we know for sure right now?
So it's still very early on in the game on this one. What we do know from South Africa, they actually just released a very snapshot report on Friday. It showed us that a lot of the cases they found, they actually found because of their surveillance. So there, many of the hospitalized cases they looked at are there for other reasons, not for COVID, which is great. Which tells us, though, that even among some vaccinated people, it has spread, but it hasn't caused a lot of illness. So right now, in the very small numbers that we've seen reported, it looks mild. And so perhaps this could be more contagious than Delta, but more mild, which would be great for us. Again, it's still very early. CDC is saying we probably need 2 to 4 weeks of data to make some more definitive remarks about things such as how effective our current vaccines are, how transmissible it really is, if there are certain populations more at risk than others, that sort of thing. But honestly, at this point here in the U.S., I'm still much more concerned about the Delta that we have here versus the Omicron that we're going to be getting possibly.
Graham, do you think we should be worried at all about Omicron at this point?
Well, yeah, I think we got to, at this point, it's, you know, the precautionary principle, right? As Shandy just said, we need another a week to 4 weeks of data to really know. And even if it is more mild, generally, mild can still have, you know, unwanted outcomes. And severe outcomes aren't the only outcomes either. We still obviously don't know anything about Omicron, the potential for long COVID as well. So I think there's a lot yet to be seen. And, you know, we've talked a lot about, you know, this path to making COVID endemic at some point. And what we're seeing right now is not it. We're not there. And this, in a way, could maybe make that longer. Because, you know, to get to an endemic disease, you basically need everybody infected or vaccinated. And if this evades natural immunity, if we call it that, or infection-induced immunity or vaccine-induced immunity, that could take a little bit longer to get there. Now, if it's less severe, like we may think, then maybe that's a good thing. And that's kind of a bridge to getting us to a more manageable, more predictable virus. But I think we all can say that, you know, we really shouldn't look to the crystal ball too much and try to make too many predictions, because we've seen this virus behave in ways that are really quite unpredictable so far.
Well, Shandy, we're going to go to break, but before we do, how many cases of COVID are Delta right now in the U.S., percentage-wise, do you think?
So it's still the dominant by far, so, you know, high 90%. And again, that could change in the coming weeks, depending on how transmissible it is. But it's really hard to predict that right now until we have more information about this new variant.
Well, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about vaccines and how those can be helpful and whether we're seeing that as a way to fight back against some of these variants that are popping up. We'll be back after a quick break. We're getting updates on the Omicron and Delta variants and plans to fight COVID spread this winter. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Shandy Dirth, Director of the Center for Public Health Practice at IUPUI School of Public Health, and Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health at Indiana University. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap, where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. And coming up next, we'll hear about why some say Indiana's guardianship system is broken. We're joined by Justin Schrock, staff attorney at Indiana Disability Rights. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Good afternoon, Miriam. Thanks for having me on today.
Before we get into the details, how would you characterize the guardianship system in Indiana right now?
Well, that's a bit of a loaded question. Overall, I have to say it's not really positive as far as the protections of rights of folks who are at risk of or under guardianship. There's far too often in cases, guardianship is really looked at as the first option for an individual with a disability who might need some kind of decision-making supports, when it really should be the option of absolute last resort because of the very fundamental and basic civil rights and liberty interests that are at stake.
So would it be fair to say that the system is not working well right now?
I think that would be very fair to say, yes.
What have you seen in your time working in this area? Has the system gotten better or worse over the years? I think for a lot of us, that the Britney Spears case highlighted this on a much bigger level. Did that push any changes at all?
I think the Britney Spears case, if nothing else, did substantially improve public awareness of what guardianship is. And I think it's important to keep in context, not just guardianship, but kind of where, as a country, we've come in the past, say, 50 years when it comes to the treatment of people with disabilities. It wasn't long ago when folks with disabilities didn't have the right to live in their own community, didn't have the right to attend school with their peers. So although there is certainly still a lot of improvements that we need to make, things have come a long way. I would say in the time that I've been at Indiana Disability Rights, and I've been with them since the summer of 2015, things have improved slightly. The supported decision-making bill that passed and went into effect in 2019 has been beneficial to some degree. I would agree with Carter's characterization that she mentioned. I don't think we can say that it's substantially improved things, but I think it has helped slightly move the needle in the right direction. So there is some progress being made, but it is very slow going.
Is this perhaps something that will take a long time to see any changes, just because, I don't know, things in the system sometimes take a while to change? Or I guess, like, what would be needed for there to be just like some big overhaul?
So looking at Indiana's guardianship code, I would say if I had to narrow it down to three things that would substantially improve our guardianship system, one would be a guaranteed right to independent legal counsel if someone requests it who is either already under guardianship or who's, you know, someone has alleged that they're in need of guardianship. Right now, there's no right to legal counsel whatsoever. It's incredibly rare for someone who's been alleged to be an incapacitated person or someone under guardianship to have an attorney representing their individual legal interests and what they want. What Indiana uses instead, and I would say is one of about 10 states, that rather than guaranteeing some right to independent legal counsel, we instead use what are called guardians ad litem, or GALs. And you might have heard that term before, because GALs are used pretty frequently in other contexts. But those are exclusively in cases involving children. So for example, parental divorce proceedings where custody or parenting time is contested, child in need of service cases, termination of parental rights proceedings, juvenile delinquency proceedings. And in most of those, it's not even the child's legal interests that are primarily at issue, it's the parents. And the role of the GAL, whether in one of these matters that involve children or in adult guardianship cases, is not to advocate for what that individual wants. Their job is to perform some kind of assessment of the situation and then make a report to the court as far as what they believe is in the, quote, best interests of the individual. And a best interest standard is not anything close to what, you know, we would think of, you know, in terms of a regular attorney client relationship, where, you know, if I'm representing someone, I have an obligation to advocate for what my client wants. You know, I can't argue to the court if I disagree with, you know, what my client is asking for and say, you know, Your Honor, my client wants this to happen, but I really think this would be better for them. That's not how it works, but that's really all that in Indiana we've determined that folks who are at risk of or under guardianship are entitled to.
I have to say the one thing that struck me was the fact that folks who are in a guardianship cannot have their own legal counsel, or if they want to get a lawyer, they have to ask permission from the guardians. It just seems like go ahead.
So, and just to kind of make a point of clarification there, and that is, for the most part, that is accurate because, you know, folks under guardianship typically have pretty minimal financial resources. And even, you know, say in Nick's case, he had, you know, somewhat substantial financial resources, but no direct control over them. So how is he realistically going to find a private attorney? Now, for Nick's case, he happened to get connected with Indiana Disability Rights. We accepted his case, did some fact finding and offered to represent him, but we didn't necessarily need to get permission from his parents to represent him. So that's just a small point of clarification, but by and large, it is accurate to say that someone under guardianship has really no realistic means to find their own legal counsel unless somehow they're able to find someone who's willing to represent them for free.
Right. And I'm guessing that's really hard to find for cases like this.
Yeah, there are maybe a handful of other attorneys in the state who I know of who do that. There are several folks over at Indiana Legal Services and various offices in the state who I know will handle those cases from time to time. And then there's me. but outside of that, I'm not aware of anyone who regularly handles these sorts of cases.
What has your experience been in handling these cases? When you go to different counties across the state, are things handled differently, or is everything pretty much the same under like an Indiana law or something?
So there is a pretty widely recognized discrepancy in how guardianships are carried out in more populous counties versus more rural counties. And that has to do, it's for two reasons, really. One is that more populous counties like Marion, Allen, Lake tend to have dedicated probate courts. So those judges only hear, matters regarding estates, you know, matters relating to trust and guardianship cases all day, every day. So those judges know the law very well when it comes to guardianship. So although, you know, there are very minimal due process protections in Indiana's guardianship code, at least those judges are, for the most part, ensuring that those laws are followed. Now, when you look at rural counties where judges might hear guardianship cases, they might hear criminal matters, divorces, you know, just a wide range of cases before them. And, you know, judges are humans. They can't be experts on, you know, every area of law. And when it comes down to it, they're making, you know, judgments based on the laws and arguments put before them. So circling back around to the lack of a right to independent legal counsel, you know, in a lot of cases, if, say, someone is petitioning for guardianship over another individual and either the individual or their attorney just blatantly disregards the law, if there's no one to speak up and bring that to the judge's attention, then, you know, a lot of times that just gets missed. So I not infrequently have seen guardianships that are established without a hearing. Sometimes the day after a petition is filed, often with maybe no or very minimal evidence that goes along with it. There's also, I would say, in rural counties, I see a lot of misuse of consents to guardianships. Our code, I'm not sure why, but our guardianship code does allow someone going through a guardianship proceeding or already under guardianship to waive their rights to notice of proceedings regarding the guardianship and to attendance at hearings, and also to indicate their consent to a guardianship. However, the state laws that apply to those explicitly state those waivers or consents have to be provided, quote, knowingly and voluntarily. So what I see on a semi-regular basis in particularly rural counties is there will be a petition for guardianship filed. Maybe there's a very short physician statement of some sort that's submitted along with it. And then the guardian's attorney will have the individual who the guardianship is being sought over sign a form saying they waive these rights and consent to the guardianship. And then it's filed. And sometimes these judges are reviewing that and then just approving the guardianship without ever having even laid eyes on the individual or hearing any evidence beyond that. It's just a miscarriage of justice, if you will.
We have a comment from Tarina on Facebook who says one of the largest school districts in the state is pushing parents to seek guardianship for their children with intellectual disabilities as soon as they turn 18 and planting fear in the parents. It's unfortunate that the right to try supported decision making first is being ignored. Is it common that schools in Indiana push parents to seek guardianship, and why would they do that?
Well, to answer the first question, yes, it is common. There's school to guardianship pipeline that is often referenced, and that is that's getting better very slowly. More special education coordinators and teachers are learning about supported decision making and other less restrictive alternatives to guardianship, but in a lot of communities that's not the case. Now as far as why that happens, it's tough to say. I think many times it could be a lack of awareness of those options. It could be, you know, kind of those longstanding societal biases against folks with disabilities and this idea that people with disabilities, need protection from some theoretical harm rather than respect for their individual rights. And what's ironic about there being a school to guardianship pipeline in Indiana specifically is that Article 7, our set of regulations that lay out our guardianship laws, and then or not guardianship, our special education laws in Indiana, it provides the option to for a student once they turn 18 to appoint what's called an educational representative, where they can, it's almost like a power of attorney, where they can appoint typically their parent to be able to continue to help them make decisions regarding their special education services. And the applicable regulation actually also provides an option for the appointment of an educational representative even if the student isn't believed to possess the capacity to make that appointment. So really there's no reason that a guardianship should ever be established in Indiana purely for the purposes of managing a student's special education services. But we do see that being a big precursor to that pretty often.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left here. If someone takes on a guardianship, are they legally responsible for anything that the person in their care does? I mean, is that something that folks should maybe think twice about?
So that's a difficult question to answer because the code isn't entirely clear. There are some circumstances where a guardian might be held liable, but typically, no, they're not going to be.
Okay, because I was just thinking, you know, maybe that would make some folks try another route rather than trying to take control of someone's life.
Right.
Is there anything before we let you go that you think we might see some changes in the near future?
I know... when you talk to Carly after me, she might be talking about some of the kind of tangential or guardianship related matters that might be happening going through the legislature. I don't know about any pending bills that are coming up that would substantially impact the rights of folks under guardianship. But I guess to quickly circle back around to one of your earlier questions, and when I mentioned, and I kind of got sidetracked about the right to independent legal counsel, a couple of other things that I think would significantly improve our guardianship system, in addition to a recognized right to independent legal counsel, would be an established right for individuals under guardianship to periodically request review hearings for the continued necessity of the guardianship. There's currently no requirement for that. And also the establishment of some sort of process where folks under guardianship can submit complaints about their guardians and have those addressed informally.
Thank you so much, Justin Schrock, as a staff attorney at Indiana Disability Rights. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're discussing the science of gratitude and its positive impact on our mental health and well-being. We're joined by Janae Nelson, a PhD candidate at Brigham Young University, and Joel Wong, professor and department chair for the Counseling and Educational Psychology Department at Indiana University. Janae, I was just thinking about this during the break as we were talking about the gratitude light stuff. I recently saw a post on LinkedIn where someone was saying, please stop taking pictures of yourself helping those in need and posting it all over social media. Is that a form of gratitude light, trying to show that you're grateful for the life that you have and you're helping other people?
Absolutely. Roy Baumeister talks about this as, again, it's that self-presentation. It's about what is the goal of your post? Is the goal to show off and to get kudos for what you've done? Or is it to genuinely uplift other people around you by sharing this gratitude? And I think that's kind of the litmus test right there, is the your motivation behind what you're posting. And that motivation makes people feel differently. If you're just doing it for self-preservation or self-presentation, a lot of times it makes people not even like you because they're making judgments about you. Or it can make them feel really bad about themselves if you're posting about this brand new thing you got, for example, and it's something that you don't have.
Well, earlier we talked about the impact gratitude has on mental health. Joel, what happens physiologically? Is there anything that it affects that way?
Yeah, there's, there's some fascinating research even on the physiological and health benefits of gratitude and gratitude as well as gratitude interventions have been associated with a bunch of physiological outcomes like lower blood pressure, better sleep, for example, and even moving into health behaviors, more exercise. Actually, that was one of the studies, first studies on gratitude interventions by Bob Emmons, who found that people who participated in gratitude interventions were more likely to exercise. And we all know the health benefits of physical exercise, right? Which you can see why it leads to lower blood pressure, better sleep quality, lower levels of stress as evidenced by the cortisol levels. So all of these are health markers that in turn confer long-term health benefits as well as mental health benefits.
Janae, how does gratitude affect our relationships with other people?
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned this a little bit earlier, but for religious people, when you are acknowledging your gratitude to God, it makes you closer. It makes you feel closer to God. And so it improves that relationship. And it does the same thing interpersonally. So when you are acknowledging that somebody has done something for you and you really do feel gratitude towards that thing that they've done, then you also feel closer to them. So it strengthens that relationship, and it also makes you want to reciprocate. And those are things that we found in our research. So both of those relationship strengthening functions occur interpersonally and towards God.
It sounds like there's just so many positive benefits to practicing gratitude. But Joel, is there a way that it can have a negative impact?
You know, that's a really interesting question. There is an entire book I have sort of summarizing the research on gratitude, researchers have found very few negative outcomes that could be associated with gratitude if you define gratitude correctly, not as a form of indebtedness, which is not the same as gratitude. You know, indebtedness means if you are obliged to repay someone for what they've done for you, but it's not a positive feeling. It's this feeling of like, oh, it's like I got this burden on my shoulders that I need to kind of unload because I feel indebted to you. Whereas gratitude is often a positive feeling, like I want to do it because it comes from the bottom of my heart. I want to repay you. Now, with that said, it's possible that, in some cases, perhaps, you know, in such one classic example that's often cited would be, say, if you are in a relationship that's unhealthy, but for whatever reason, you are very grateful to the person, which might make it harder for you to get out of that relationship if that's actually a destructive relationship. Or it might, that sense of gratitude and loyalty to that person might make it harder for you to go against that person, even if you should. Maybe in a case where, say, if you're really grateful to a supervisor who's engaged in very unethical or illegal behaviors. We have seen a little bit of that sometimes in politics. Mm-hmm. And some of that sense of gratitude makes it a little bit harder for you to be able to disengage from that or to report a person to whom you're grateful for, who perhaps needs to be reported to the authorities.
Yeah, that sounds like a whole other topic that we could talk about for a while.
Yeah.
Janae, you know, with the holiday seasons, it seems like these types of topics pop up for folks to be grateful, to reflect on the past year. Do you think people practice gratitude enough throughout the rest of the year?
I think that people definitely get a boost around this time of year. But as far as it becoming a year-round practice, I would be less optimistic about that, which is a shame because, like we've talked about, there are so many positive, effects of practicing gratitude daily. So I would hope that that moves on. I want to speak to backtrack a little bit to what Joel is talking about with indebtedness, because this is another area that I've recently published on. Aversive indebtedness is, like Joel mentioned, it is a different thing than gratitude. There's also positive indebtedness, and this is something that we're newly finding, brand new research on this. Think about the indebtedness you have to your mother for giving you life, for example. You don't necessarily feel bad about that. So indebtedness isn't always a negative emotion. It can be, and it often is, but a lot of times it's not. And especially in societies that embrace more of that interdependence versus our individualism that we have, indebtedness can be experienced quite positively. And indebtedness to God is one example. People feel indebted to God like they could never repay him, and but that in turn increases their gratitude. And so in that sense, indebtedness, that positive indebtedness can be an important component of gratitude. But it is important to notice that aversive indebtedness is associated with negative emotions and not always a good thing to experience.
So if somebody were feeling sort of negative about some kind of indebtedness that they are going through, that's probably a red flag.
Yeah. And I think, especially around the holidays, this is a good example. When somebody you go to the gift exchange and somebody gives you a gift that's, way more expensive than the gift you gave them, you feel indebted and you don't, it's not comfortable, right?
Yeah.
But when somebody that you really love and care about gives you a gift that's more than yours, you might be quite comfortable with that indebtedness. It might actually make you feel more gratitude and more love towards that person. Like, wow, I can't believe they would do so much for me. And so again, it goes back to that attribution and how you view that gift and how you view the giver. The relationship with the giver really makes a difference in whether or not you feel aversive indebtedness versus a positive, what Bob Roberts calls glad indebtedness.
Joel, I want to get to what we can do in our everyday lives to incorporate gratitude for our listeners here to take some solutions with them from our conversation. What would you suggest people do to incorporate it in their everyday lives?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. So I've really made it an important goal in my life, in my professional life, to find ways to promote the lifelong practice of gratitude. And that means not just doing it around the holiday season. And part of it is looking into the research, kind of experimenting with things that I've been doing myself. I've got some suggestions for people to consider. The first and probably the easiest thing to do is to start and maintain a gratitude journal. And just the key is just to spend no more than a few minutes on it to make it really easy. If it becomes too complicated, it's probably not something you can do long term. But spend no more than 5 minutes a day, but to do it every day or at least five times a week, and just write down what you're grateful for and why. You could just write one thing you're grateful for, or in my case, I write three things that I'm grateful for. And I try to provide a reason why. You can do it in any way. You can do the traditional, handwriting in a journal, or there are a lot of online apps that one can use. There's one that I could recommend if you don't have an idea at all, kind of a platform, and I'm not making any money out of it. It's a nonprofit. That's thanksfor.org, THNX4. .org, and that's funded by the Greater Good Science Center, which is nonprofit, and that's a good place for you to write. And the key is to have a place and a time. Set a time, set a place for doing it. So tell yourself the way to develop a good habit is at 9 a.m. 9 a.m. on my in my favorite chair at home or my couch. That's where I'm going to be doing my gratitude journaling. Now, I have a hypothesis, and this is not been fully tested yet, but something that I've been thinking about, which is that you would be more likely to maintain this habit of journaling if you do it together with others, so that there's that accountability function. And take it a step farther to do it using kind of a group-based gratitude journaling. And the THNX4.org platform does allow for an opportunity for group-based journaling, where a group of people can come together and say, 10 of us, we're going to journal together, and we can see each other and what we write. And that encourages us to keep at it and keep working on it together. And that's that sense of accountability. So my hypothesis is that could help you to go even further. The second thing I would recommend, other than gratitude journaling, is to express gratitude to people, kind of heartfelt gratitude. And that maybe like make it a goal to do it once a week. It doesn't have to be oral. It could be in written form. For me, it's a personal goal to do it at least once a week, where, just send an email, a short message to someone to just tell them how you're grateful to them. Not just saying thanks, but kind of explaining, hey, you did this for me and I'm really grateful. So I call that heartfelt gratitude that goes beyond simply saying thanks. One more thing I want to say, and this comes back to what you and Jenny had earlier discussed. There is a little bit of research that I've seen that's fascinating that suggests that gratitude will be more likely to be perceived as genuine and positive if you express the gratitude privately as opposed to publicly. So that sense of like, I'm telling the whole world how grateful I am, is sometimes perceived as less genuine. But when you take the effort to personally and privately tell a person how grateful you are, that can actually be more powerful, ironically and counterintuitively, more powerful than making all these public proclamations.
Janae, what are your thoughts on ways people can practice gratitude?
Well, I think Joel's the real expert with the application, and I think that he summarized it really well. From a religious perspective, I would add that prayer and meditation can also be powerful practices where you express gratitude, and whether you're a religious person or not, you can, like I mentioned, do that during in meditation. And I think that that is also a very centering and powerful practice if you can incorporate that into your gratitude practices.
Janae, do you think that, and I don't know if we mentioned this already earlier, but is practicing gratitude a way to shift your mind focus to become a more positive person? Let's say like you always see things in a negative light, but if you practice gratitude, would that change your mindset?
It does. And we see that. We see that people who experience gratitude or who are acknowledging the gifts in their life report more happiness. They report more feelings of love, more relationship closeness. And so there's definitely evidence for that.
We have a few minutes left here. What advice would you give to folks who are tuning in and they want to try gratitude for the first time and they don't know what's the best step to take?
I would say that Joel's given us a lot of great ideas, and the journaling and the meditation and prayer, those are all really fantastic ways to get started. And like Joel said, it's not something that should take a lot of time. And even the smallest amount can really have exponential benefits in your life.
And Joel, about the gratitude journal, because I'm taking notes for myself here. Do you have to write the same thing every day? Can you write the same thing every day? I feel like someone once told me, like, write three things, but they can't be the same every single day. And I was like, I don't have enough time to think about stuff like that.
Yeah. So I have a theory about why gratitude journaling is so powerful. And that's because we know from research that there's this problem called hedonic adaptation, which is that if you do something, the same thing repeatedly over and over again, you sort of, you lose a bit of the pleasure and benefit that you get out of it. And something that you used to really enjoy becomes less and less enjoyable. So the question is, well, could the same thing happen with gratitude journaling? I think the trick is the way to avoid that is to introduce variety in kind of what you write about. Now, you're saying, like, how do I do that? Or like, what can I think about? there are many tricks you can use. If it's like, you know, for today, I can only think of one thing that I'm grateful for and just my mind is a little bit stuck, I will say, why don't you just write about that one thing, but think about three benefits that you derived from that one thing. And this is where I get creative myself. You know, if I'm thinking about, oh, I'm really grateful because I spent lunch with a friend and had a really good time talking, I would think of, I'll write three things about what was positive about that lunch. So it becomes three different facets of it, of the same thing, right?
Oh, that's really cool.
The other thing that I have done, and I don't have this right now with me that I can make, but I have created 80 questions that you can ask yourself to help you generate different things that you've been grateful for, ranging from the most trivial things like, something like finding parking, to really profound and existential questions that you can consider from intrapersonal to interpersonal.
Well, thank you so much to all of you for joining us. We're just out of time. Janae Nelson is a PhD candidate at Brigham Young University, and Joel Wong is a professor and the department chair for the Counseling and Educational Psychology Department at Indiana University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.